Next case is 04-1812, Disciplinary Counsel versus Daryl Wendell Holland. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Alvin Matthews, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Daryl Holland, who's seated there at council table. His father is also present with us here today, and we'd like to reserve about 5 minutes of our time so that Mr. Holland can address the panel, much in the way that Christine Johnson did yesterday in her case.
Time there on the clock.
Thank you. Your Honors, this is a case, and we believe it's an important case, about multiple billing, double billing for clients represented in court in this case, and how lawyers should bill that time, and whether that overbilling of that time constitutes dishonesty, fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, or whether it's simply an overbilling issue. And I don't mean it to say simply an overbilling issue to minimize that, because that is important, an important message that we should send to lawyers about how they should bill their time. But we would respectfully suggest in this case that the Board of Commissioners' finding by clear and convincing evidence of dishonesty in this case was incorrect, and that a state suspension should be entered in this case by the court. One of the main things that I'd like to point out today, and I know this court has heard many arguments yesterday when in the Christine Johnson case, is that there's more than one way to look at billing, client billing. And we will be the first to say in this case that the way that Mr. Holland billed his client was wrong, his clients in these cases. But one of the things that clearly illustrates the differences in that lawyers think about these particular questions is to look at relator's brief, and then to look at that advisory opinion, which is 93-379, that was attached to his brief. And in that particular advisory opinion, they talk about the question of double billing in various scenarios. And they said, they talk about in the context of in-court double billing of clients. They talk about in the context of the lawyer who is on the plane billing one client for travel and then billing another client for writing a motion. They talk about it in the context of lawyers who research an issue and then recycle that research and then charge other clients for that
counsel,
same research.
Counsel, in this situation, there were instructions on the timesheet on how to bill for time spent for in-court time. So it was pretty clear. You didn't have to be clairvoyant to figure out what the court expected.
Well, Your Honor, and I'm glad you raised that point, because that does go to the heart of this case, the form. I think the form is one of the issues that go to Mr. Holland's intent in this case, but there are other surrounding circumstances. We can't go inside his head and see why he put down 3 hours for all of those cases. But we can look at the surrounding circumstances, and we can ascertain from those surrounding circumstances why he did what he did. But relative to this advisory opinion, it puts forth the question, and by the way, the ABA nor your Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline write advisory opinions on issues about lying to clients, lying to the court, stealing money. They don't talk about any of that stuff in advisory opinions. They talk about questions that are problematic to the bar. And in 1993, somebody said, in the age of professionalism, and this court had a professionalism commission during that time period, they said that clients are upset about the way that lawyers are billing, and we need to get this under control. And so when you are in court for three clients fortuitously, you have to bill that correctly. When you're on a plane and you're working for one client, you can't bill another client for that same time. You have to allocate it. And so this is not an easy question. It's not a black and white question. But back to the form, and I think the form is important, why did Mr. Holland put down 3 hours on that form? He didn't pull the number out of the air. He didn't pull the number out of the air. It was because they were in court for 3 hours. And much like that advisory opinion talks about, do you allocate that time, do you split it up, or do you put down all three? He made the wrong decision from day one on appointed cases to, instead of allocating that time, to put down 3 hours. He was there for 3 hours, but it wasn't on that case. And so when you look at that form and what it says, he's operating under a false assumption from the very beginning. And that's the problem here.
Are you saying that he did not understand the form?
What I'm suggesting here is that he operated under the wrong assumption and put down 3 flat hours instead of allocating the time amongst the clients.
We know what he did. And my question to you, was there something on that form that was confusing? Was there some reason why he chose to mislead with both the information he put on the form and then submitting that form to the judge for signature and then reimbursement?
Well, certainly, in retrospect, the form looks a lot more clear to us than it probably looked to him at the time. And this form may have evolved over time, much as the way in which they billed. I think it started out they would bill 1 flat hour for each case. Then it went to a tenth of an hour. But the form is explanatory in terms of how many hours were you in court. He put down 3. How many hours were you out of court? And he put down 3 in every case. He was very open about it. He wasn't trying to lie or deceive.
He wouldn't have been paid for that time had he not put it on the form.
Pardon me?
He would not have been paid for that time had he not put it on the form. So it's not a question of being open. If you want to get 3 hours times $40, you're going to put 3 hours down, whether you spent the time on the client's case or not.
Incidentally, he was not paid for these cases that are at issue here. As a result of the audit, the Public Defender Commission held up the money, and then they only paid him a portion of that money toward the end. So he wasn't paid the $11,000 that was at issue and then had to reimburse some. They withheld that money because they conducted an audit.
So there's no issue of restitution here. Is that what you're telling us?
We don't believe that there is, Your Honor, because he worked it out with the county, and this was post-criminal case. This was post-criminal case. Another point that we want to point out, Your Honors, is this notion of notice that Mr. Holland received. The very first time that anybody told him that his billing was wrong was when he was invited to meet with a detective. Now, the form says that a lawyer has to approve their hours, and that's correct. And it also says in the second phase that a judge looks at the hours and they appear to be reasonable. Then it goes down and it says that the county commission should look at the hours and approve it. And then it says at the bottom that the Public Defender Commission can ultimately audit these hours, and then if the hours are wrong, you're going to be notified.
But don't each of those entities assume that a lawyer is going to be honest when he or she signs a form claiming that they represented clients for X number of hours or minutes? We assume that a lawyer is honest, and
yes,
here the assumption was denied.
Yes, Your Honor, they certainly should assume, and we're not blaming others. We certainly should assume that a lawyer is going to be honest. But what I'm suggesting, and I think it goes to the dishonesty claim in this case, that Mr. Holland had, after he made the false assumption that he could bill these 3 hours flat for each case, after he operated under that false assumption and made that from the beginning, he had no one that told him differently until he was under investigation
No one told him he should not be billing the state for hours that he didn't represent clients. No one told him that, that's his excuse. Nobody told me I was doing something wrong. I was being dishonest. Nobody told me to stop.
Well, we don't believe that he was being dishonest. We believe that he put down too much time.
Sure, he did reveal on a piece of paper what an investigator could determine was incorrect. Let me ask you, Mr. Matthews, does the record in this case indicate, we know from yesterday's case that the public defender's office here in Columbus apparently detected this overbilling, and that they found 3 attorneys apparently in Stark County who were overbilling in this manner. Do we know how many lawyers were reviewed? Does the record indicate that?
There is some reference in the record about 40 lawyers, I guess, that were involved in the program initially. And then they narrowed it down to a fewer number of lawyers. And then they were looking at about 5 lawyers. And then they ended up with the 3. And the reason they came up with the 3 lawyers is because these lawyers were billing for in-court time, the most obvious to find out. There were other lawyers who may have padded their out-of-court time, but these lawyers had actually overbilled for in-court time, and it was obvious to anybody.
Right. But
except
we have
your client.
3 of 40, right? We have essentially three of 40 that... So this was not something that was widespread. I mean, there were lawyers who knew how to do this or who did it correctly. That's
not correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
What we're suggesting here is that somebody drew an arbitrary line, and Mr. Holland will tell you that once they reimbursed his money, and I think Ms. Johnson told you yesterday, they drew a line at 2 hours, and they said, okay, it's okay to bill these clients for 2 hours, but you can't bill them for 3. So there may have been, if we take the scenario that these lawyers were billing for more than they should have, why do you draw the arbitrary line at 2 hours and then criminally prosecute some people and then everybody else walks away? And then what about the people who are overbilling on out-of-court hours? Because to me, that's a more apparent dishonesty.
We don't have any evidence of that here, do we? There's no evidence of lawyers. This is a discipline case. We don't have any evidence here of lawyers overbilling for their out-of-court time, do we?
Well, we do know from the record that there were more lawyers under investigation and that there were reasons for doing different things. And we do know that 3 lawyers were prosecuted, and the ones that were for in-court time. Those were the more obvious cases.
Let me ask you, as we know, I think, Ms. Johnson, who was here yesterday on the same sort of factual situation, worked for Mr. Holland for several as a secretary, I guess, and she said she learned this procedure from him because he'd been doing it consistently. The board has recommended the same sanction for both lawyers. Should we consider the fact that he was a mentor and she learned from him and thought this was her argument was, well, he did it, and so I thought the court was all right to do it. Should we be looking at a stricter, stronger penalty for him, sanction? You'll probably say no, I would guess, but why not?
Well, both lawyers did it for the same reason, because in their heart, and we can look at it in retrospect, certainly, and say this was wrong. We can look at it in retrospect and say he billed them too much, but neither one of them had dishonest motives for doing it.
Well, they got some extra money that they hadn't earned for.
Well, they never received that money initially.
Well, but they would have. That's
right.
Only because somebody caught them.
And we certainly understand that finally, and of course it was a very abrupt way to find out that they had a problem. The public defender came to them, but the first time someone came to them, it was with criminal charges. In this case. So we would respectfully urge in this case that, and again, he accepts the responsibility for the mentoring and failing in that regard with regard to Ms. Johnson. He certainly accepts that responsibility. We respectfully urge that there's no dishonesty in this case. If you look at all the surrounding circumstances, which you must do under Ohio law, that there's no clear and convincing evidence of dishonesty, and that there should be a state suspension in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. The record in this matter shows that respondent Darrell Holland submitted 123 false and inflated fee applications, claiming hours on 34 days in excess, claiming in-court hours on 34 days in excess of the hours the court was in session on those days.
Mr. Berger, why is the disciplinary counsel suggesting that the sanction should be the same as the case we heard yesterday?
Your Honor, we see that we view the responsibility on Respondent Holland and Respondent Johnson to be the same. Respondent Johnson states she learned the practice through working with Mr. Holland. Nonetheless, as an attorney, we all have the same obligation to know and understand the rules. And there were three things that should have told both of them, Holland and Johnson, that this billing was not appropriate. Number one is common sense. That should be evident to everyone. Number two is Disciplinary Rule 2106, which all attorneys are required to be familiar with. And number three is the explicit instructions on the fee form application. Opposing counsel raised the issue of whether or not this overbilling is dishonesty. This court has already spoken on that matter. In the Bat case, this court held padding client bills was the equivalent of misappropriation. In the Nineighbor case, this court held seeking unmerited compensation for court appointments requires an actual suspension from the practice of law.
Counsel, yesterday you gave us a figure for Ms. Johnson that you felt was the amount overbilled despite the possible settlement with the criminal case amount. Do you have a similar figure in this case?
There's a figure in the record that was calculated by the prosecutor that was, I believe, $11,570.
Do you agree that Mr. Holland has not received, because the public defender withheld payment, reimbursement, do you agree that there's no restitution owing here?
It's my understanding, based on testimony at the hearing, that the matter was resolved between Mr. Holland and the county. And Mr. Holland testified at that hearing that the county went through and reduced each of his bills. They cut his hours in half. And in doing so, they then settled with him and paid him what was due on all of the pending applications.
Is that at the risk of doing something we never do? But the other case yesterday was similar. I think there was a little confusion at the end of that case exactly what was due. Was the same procedure used in determining how much, what the reimbursement should be as in this case?
Your Honor, all I can do is tell you the testimony from the hearing. The record indicates in both matters, Holland and Johnson had not only the applications pending that are in the record in this matter, but numerous other applications. Once the investigation started, the county put a hold on paying all applications. So the final compensation included applications in addition to what was being reviewed in the criminal matter. Johnson testified at the disciplinary hearing that they reduced her application, each application, by $60. Mr. Holland testified at the hearing that they cut his hours in half. So it appears as if they may have used a different formula in determining what the appropriate payment would be.
But according to your records here, the billing is triple billing. So we're talking about triple billing and yet a settlement of half. Is that what you're saying?
According to Mr. Holland's testimony, what they did is they reduced his hours by half. So I don't understand the basis for the court's decision, but that's my understanding of what occurred in the settlement.
As you know from my comments yesterday, the public defender funds are pretty scarce funds, and public defender's office never has enough money from the legislature to do all the things it wants to do. And here we have two lawyers who have essentially diminished, not in great numbers, but diminished the ability of the public defender to represent legitimate clients, represent clients. So I guess picking up on Justice Lansinger's question, why shouldn't we perhaps look at exactly what, in determining the sanction here, why should we not consider precisely the amount of fees that were earned by the work that was performed by, let's say, Mr. Holland in this case? Relator wouldn't have any objection to that, I assume, would you?
Your Honor, the fact remains the same, regardless of how much fee you determined that Johnson or Holland were entitled to. Both of them submitted false and inflated fee applications, so that is our concern. The actual amount is less of a concern to us in making the argument. Our concern is each time they submit an application, it was a dishonest act. Respondent's counsel suggested that surrounding circumstances may justify the overbilling actions, but the record shows that the judges did not approve of or condone these procedures, and no attorneys besides Johnson and Holland testified that they billed in this manner. Further, the form has another specific requirement listed on it that I'd like to address. The form states that you can only claim time spent representing the client listed on the form. So if you're signing the form attesting to the accuracy of it, and you're claiming time spent representing another client, you're not correctly completing the form. The issue was raised by opposing counsel regarding out-of-court billing. In the Johnson matter, it was alleged that she overbilled both in court and out of court, and the record in that matter shows that she billed more than 24 hours in out of court billing on individual days as well. Finally, I'd like to share with the court why Relator believes that respondent's case law is not controlling in this matter. In the Cincinnati Bar Association versus Asfelder matter, the client was aware of the billing practices and agreed to the billing practices by Mr. Asfelder. In the Disciplinary Counsel versus Henderson matter, Henderson, the record demonstrates, actually worked the hours that he was paid for. There's no dispute that there was not work completed. In Stark County versus Watterson, there's two fee-related questions. In count two, there was no submission of any false document to the court or a client, and therefore it's a different issue. In count three, the client both agreed with the fee arrangement and signed a fee agreement consenting to those terms that were later found to be inappropriate. At this point, I'll conclude unless the panel has any additional questions. Thank you. We just request that this court adopt the board's recommendation and suspend the respondent for 1 year with 6 months stay.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Holland, Mr. Matthews has saved a little more than a minute of his time. It may take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Whatever the court's disposition in this case, I want you to know that it was always my goal to provide the very best counsel to the children and the families in the Stark County Family Court. Although the focus of the proceedings has always been on my billing procedures, which obviously were wrong as I understand today, my focus was always to serve the family court as an officer of the court to the very best of my abilities. It has been stated that I am not sorry. I am truly sorry that in the course of serving those families to the best of my ability, I did not apply the same appropriate standards to the billing procedures in my office. I strove to apply those ethical and moral standards of the profession in the representation of my clients and failed to apply those same high standards to my billing practices. Although everything I did was in accordance with the court's established procedures, as those of us who serve the court on appointed cases understood them, I should have looked further. My failure was not in following a lawyer's higher calling, which is the calling of this court's ethical canons. My duty as an attorney and the morals set down by my faith. I am deeply grieved that my actions have brought disrepute upon my fellow members of the bar. My record, I trust, indicates that I have done my best to maintain the ideals dictated by my personal sense of morality as well as the rules of ethics that govern my profession. My poor judgment has deeply wounded my reputation as well as caused immeasurable emotional harm to me personally and more importantly to those I love. I now recognize that regardless of the circumstances that gave rise to the perceived approval of my billing methods, it was my responsibility to make sure that my billing methods were in accordance with the rules of ethics. This I failed to do, and I have paid a price for my failure to do so. My actions were the result of mistake and neglect on my part. Please know that there was never any intent on my part to deceive or make representations to anyone that were false with regard to my billing practices. Ladies and gentlemen, I am prepared to accept your disposition. I would ask you, though, to understand, once again, that it was never my intention to purposefully take resources from anyone that I did not honestly, in my heart of hearts, feel was that to which I was entitled. Fault me, if you will, for ignorance and poor judgment, but please know that my intentions were honorable and in keeping with what I believe are the highest ideals of my profession, even if my method of obtaining compensation for those services was flawed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.